Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. One of our very first guests, I think within the first week or two, was Peter Weiner from the Ethics Public Policy Center, a well-known conservative writer for many years, contributor to The Atlantic and to The New York Times, and he has a new book out, and we are lucky enough to have him join us today. So thank you, Pete, for coming back on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me on, Charlie. I enjoyed it very much.
It seems very timely that your book would come out this week, The Death of Politics. And you write, this book began to take shape from the realization that any nation that elects Donald Trump to be its president has a dangerously low view of politics. He is the culmination of a long-term destructive trend, which is the public's utter contempt for politics. So I want to get into where this fits into this whole debate about Sohrab Ahmari and the illiberal rejection of liberal democratic pluralism and all of that. I want to get to that because I think this is very much at the center of what you are writing about, the attack on civility and decency. But let's talk about the public's utter contempt for politics. You know, for a long time, I think people cultivated a certain contempt and disdain for politics as a sign of sophistication, and it's not necessarily new. If you go back and you read H.L. Mencken, you realize that really what animated him was the sense that politics was bunkum, and that the average person deserved exactly what they got, and they deserved it good and hard. So what are you talking about? What is the new version of the utter contempt of politics that gets us Donald Trump, gets us this moment?
Yeah, it's true what you say. I mean, throughout American history, there's been skepticism and even some degree of cynicism about politics. Some of it's not bad. The public should be skeptical about politicians. They should hold them accountable. They should be wary about politics and how it can be misused. And there are plenty of reasons to be frustrated with politics, but I think we're in a new and different era than we have been before. I think there is a kind of corrosive cynicism that has taken over in a way that's very unhealthy. And I think it's unhealthy for several reasons. For one of the reasons, is that politics actually matters a lot. It's an imperfect profession, but it is in important ways a noble profession because politics is finally and fundamentally about justice and the pursuit of justice. That's not all that it's about, but at its best, it embodies that. And if you forget that, or if you think that politics is simply a rigged power game, and you lose sight of the higher good that it can do, then the pursuit of justice is either slowed down, impeded, or stopped altogether. So I think it's a view of politics that's frankly unwarranted. Secondly, I just say as a side note on this, there's more complicity that the public has in what's wrong with politics, and I think they tend to own up to. There's a feeling that you hear a lot, which is, you know, our political system is broken and our country is fine, or that the politics, our political leaders don't reflect the good sense and the common sense of the American people. In fact, our politics is broken because in many ways our country is broken. And the people who are elected and don't appear out of nowhere. They AOC and Jim Jordan are elected by constituents, and Ted Cruz and Elizabeth Warren are elected by the citizens of Texas and Massachusetts. And then they go to Congress and they have these kind of, fights. So I think that's important to keep in mind. As it relates to Donald Trump, we've just never elected anybody who is as psychologically and emotionally and intellectually unequipped to be president of the United States. And that's what happens when you think that anybody can run for office. If that disdain, that contempt for politics is so widespread, that they say we can take basically anybody off the street and hire him. Or in the case of Trump, I think there is, particularly on the right, I'm afraid, I say that with a lot of, some degree of reluctance, a lot of disappointment. There's a kind of nihilism out there, which is that the village needs to be burned down. There was so much antipathy toward the elite and the establishment, and the sense that politics just isn't working, that we ought to get rid of the whole thing. And I think a lot of Republicans view Trump as a kind of wrecking ball. And I think he's doing a lot of damage. And I think that's a very deeply unconservative impulse to try and burn down the village. So I don't think that contempt is warranted. And I think if it goes on, we're just going to have more and more trouble.
Well, it does become self-fulfilling, doesn't it? Because, you know, this is the moment your book is arguing for a restoration of a nobler vision of politics at a time when, frankly, you look at American politics, particularly politics on the right, and it's dumber, crueler, more dishonest, and more disconnected with reality. And you have folks who are insisting that it's not cruel enough. So, I mean, let's talk about this wrecking ball that he's taken, because, you know, we've had this debate about what he represents about American culture and whether he is an attack on democratic norms. And then along comes Sorab Amari and many other now Trumpist Republicans, conservatives, who are arguing that yeah, maybe we need to move past liberal democratic pluralism with the emphasis on decency and civility. Religious freedom is not good enough. We need to move on to taking control of the public square and then enjoying the spoils. Let me read you a paragraph from Amari's essay. Progressives, and this is an attack on David French, which I'm going to point out is really kind of could have been just as easily you, Peter. Progressives understand that the culture war means discrediting their opponents and weakening or destroying their institutions. Conservatives should approach the culture war with a similar realism. Civility and decency are secondary values. They regulate compliance with an established order and orthodoxy. We should seek to use these values to enforce our order and our orthodoxy, not pretend that they could ever be neutral. To recognize that enmity is real is its own kind of moral duty. So civility and decency, secondary values.
Yeah, that's really alarming stuff. But I think there's a kind of moral logic with where some parts of the American right have been, that there was almost inevitable that they would end up in this place. It is a rejection of classical liberalism, and it's a jettisoning what are really fundamental democratic virtues. I mean, this idea that you make civility and decency secondary values is insane, particularly if one is, in the case of the person that wrote those words, self-professing Christian. So there's that obvious conflict. But, you know, civility, I think these are tangled terms. I deal with this in the book. Mm-hmm. I have a chapter on moderation, civility, and compromise, because I think they get mangled in a lot of ways. Civility is not the opposite of convictions. And it doesn't mean that you don't have passions. It doesn't mean that you don't argue for the good and the right. It simply means that it's core level that you view other people with basic human decency and dignity, that you treat them in a certain way, that you don't view them as enemies of the state, but as opponents. But there is this rising impulse on the right, which I noticed in the 2016 campaign, and I'm sure you did too. It's a very apocalyptic view of the state of the country, the state of the culture. And when I've heard my friends, a lot of them who are evangelical Christians, they really speak about this as if it's an existential struggle. Yes. I mean, they use the language of that if the Democrats win the presidency or win in Congress, that we're the country's going to go off an edge and we're going to lose our country. We're going to lose our faith. It's the Flight 93 essay. But it just goes on.
They hate you. They hate your freedoms. They hate God. They will destroy your churches. Your children will be forced to go to book reading sessions at the local library on transgenderism.
Exactly. Yeah, no. And it's the means, you know, the ends justify the means. And they feel like that this is an apocalyptic Manichaean struggle, and they have to win, and they'll use any instruments and any weapons that they have to try and prevail. Well, and that leads to all sorts of anti-constitutional mischief. What is striking to me, and I think probably to you too, is that once upon a time, even if those attitudes existed, they wouldn't have been spoken publicly. Right. But now there is a sense in which you can say these things and get away with it. So I suppose there's something to be said for truth in advertising. I think what we're seeing is the true and deep nature of this struggle that's going on for the soul of conservatism and really the soul of American democracy.
Well, there is a sort of interior logic to this, which is that if there is an existential struggle, if they are going to destroy everything that is good and beautiful and true in our society, then can we afford to be polite? And this is the critique, of course, of classical liberalism. The classical liberalism is not about winning. It is not about getting what you want. It's about getting along. It's about getting a process.
Right.
And you are seeing the kind of exhaustion with democratic values that you've seen on the right, the European right, much more than in the American tradition. Mm-hmm. And it's really striking to me the degree to which this strain of rightism, and I don't know how big it is, does seem to be drawing inspiration from some of the ideologies that have never really played a significant role in American, the distinctively American conservative tradition.
Yeah, that's quite right. It's been, for the most part, alien to American conservatism, not, as you say, in conservatism in other continents. But this seems to be sweeping much of the West, and we're not immune to it. But what it means is that authentic conservatives and people who believe in classical liberalism have to make their arguments, and they have to make them intelligently and with conviction and with passion, because these are much deeper debates than particular policy debates. What do you do about education reform, or what do you do about welfare reform, or how do you reform entitlement programs? This is really fundamental stuff. What's the nature of the American experiment, and how important is liberalism, classical liberalism, and why do we care about procedures?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And what is the place of things like civility and compromise and moderation in American politics?
So what is, in 2019, what is authentic conservatism?
Well, I think it's a preservation of the founding principles, and I think it is what it has always been, which is this effort to conserve what's most precious about the country, but at the same time to try and reform the areas in American life that needs to be reformed. I think the classical tenets of conservatism has been free market limited government, free trade. And really for the last half century or more, American leadership in the world, a belief in a kind of moral order and a civic order. And so it's economic liberalism and social order and traditionalism. Mm-hmm. That's what conservatism has traditionally been. It's a sentiment. It's an impulse, as well as a set of policies. The policies change as the times change. But I've also thought, as long as I've been a conservative, what actually attracted me to it was a certain kind of temperament, a certain kind of disposition. And it would go under the category of a Burkean or Michael Oakeshott disposition, which is it was always alert to the dangers of unchecked passions, the importance of reason, prudence, and put prudence as a central virtue in American politics. And part of the reason that conservatives that I've long respected and what drew me to conservatism is it held up Abraham Lincoln as really, I would say, the model leader in American history. And so a lot of that temperamental conservatism, concern radicalism and jolting change and all of those elements seems to be jettisoned. What's happened, I don't even refer anymore to much of what's happening on the right as conservative at all. Mm-hmm. I think it's a kind of radical form of, and I think it is an attitude that that has its roots more in some of the far right groups that we find in Europe. So there are a lot of fundamental clashes going on.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you would say this because in George Will's book is called The Conservative Sensibility,
right.
And I've developed a more of an appreciation of that sensibility, that style, that attitude of mind. But of course, the critics, our critics on the right, would say that well, what you're really saying is that you just want to lose more slowly, that you lack the will to fight and defend these values. You are more concerned with your sensibility, with civility, with decency. Meanwhile, the country is being eroded. So this is the philosophy of weak losers. And this is very much, and you were one of the first people, I think, who put your finger on the fact that despite all the Christian rhetoric, that what we are really seeing is a Nietzschean ethic that is taking hold in Trump's right, you know, where winning is everything. It is the strong man. It is the celebration of masculine virtues, as opposed to virtues like prudence, mercy, reasonableness, tolerance, forbearance. So do you just want to lose more slowly, Mr. Weiner?
No, I don't want to lose more slowly. I actually want to win, but I want to win things that are worthy of winning. And there has to be a vision of the country, which is a high and a good one. And conservatism, rightly understood, isn't about losing more slowly. It's about reforming our institutions in ways that will lead to greater human flourishing and greater human dignity. So, conservative reforms have done great good over the years. Welfare reform was a conservative reform. That wasn't about losing more slowly. I was a very strong advocate of welfare reform because I thought it made a lot of sense. Because what you need to do in politics and in public policy is align those things to human nature. And I think that welfare reform did that, right? It incentivized work, and it set up a new system that encouraged work and responsibility. And we saw tremendous progress. We saw a 60% drop in the welfare caseload within 5 years, and the people who were still on welfare were actually doing better. Ronald Reagan had very bold proposals when he was president on tax reform, among others, and he was a deeply conservative person. So to be prudent doesn't mean that you're going to be weak or you're not going to be bold. But what it means really, in some deep way, is to understanding the times and circumstances in which you live, and then understanding with discernment what's required at those times. There's no book, you know, that you can pull off the shelf that tells you exactly what you do, because conservatism, as I've understood it, has always been deeply experiential and deeply practical. Okay. And it's always been wary of abstract ideology. That's been something that has, mm-hmm. for the most part, characterized the left, not the right. So there is a kind of conservatism of a set of Burke and Oakeshott and even of Aristotle, which takes those things into account. So that's that idea that conservatives simply want to lose more slowly is kind of sloppy nonsense.
So how did we get from that to Donald Trump? Where did the conservative movement that you and I were part of and we thought we understood, where did it make this turn to the point where it is now become, and you haven't used the term, but I'll throw it out, it's become like a cult, right. Where as opposed to one driven by ideas. And I think for me, one of the shocks, of course, was to realize how lightly held many of those values were in a movement that once did say that it was about sensibility and about certain kinds of values and ideas. And now it appears to be just much more tribal, much more cultic, and be cultic, you know, in the service of someone like Donald Trump. So you're a student of history. What happened? Any turning points, any breaking points that led us to this point?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I don't know that there. I've thought about it, and I there isn't any single thing that I can identify as an inflection point. I think it was a gradual wandering away of certain principles, a certain laziness, intellectual laziness, and frankly, a moral laziness that happened, a devaluation of ideas that occurred. You know, when you and I were growing up, and we were products in large part of the Reagan Revolution, and you think about what were the books in the 1980s that mattered to people like you and me, and really drove a lot of the conversations in the conservative circles. Losing Ground by Charles Murray on exactly. On welfare reform, mm-hmm. The Naked Public Square by Richard John Neuhaus, the Closing of the American Mind by Alan Bloom, Crime and Human Nature by James Q. Wilson and Richard Herrnstein, or the Federalist Society and Antonin Scalia. There was a real pride in the quality of the intellectual arguments. That characterized conservatism in the 80s and to some extent in the 90s, and that began to fade. I think actually, if I were to locate it to particular individuals, I would say Newt Gingrich is a much more significant figure in American politics.
No, I had that name written down here. I was going to ask you whether that was one, because I've actually, I wrote a book about how the right lost its mind, and in retrospect, I wish I'd spent more time on the role that Newt Gingrich played, then and the turn of the Republican Party to the warfare, political hand to hand warfare, and how that dismantled everything that you had described of the conservative tradition.
Well, that's right. I mean, you and I are seeing this the same way, and I mean, your book covered these issues so well. You're more of an expert on it than I am. But I have, in looking back, thought that there are several figures that are important, and I think Newt Gingrich was one of them, because he did bring to politics this kind of Manichaean children of light, children of darkness approach, an idea that politics was war. And you go back really to what he was saying in the 70s about the language that he was sending out in those memos and the attacks on the institutions. That kind of, I don't know, maybe a soft nihilism was evident there. And then when he became Speaker in 1994, that was such a huge moment. Of course, you and I celebrated it. The House had been Democrat for 40 years. Gingrich was a person who had an active mind. He's an intelligent person. He seemed to be engaged with ideas. That was an attractive side to him. The unattractive side to him was he was at heart, I think, a revolutionary. Mm-hmm. And I think he's somebody who is irresponsible, frankly, in some deep and fundamental ways, and that there are no limits and no checks. And he views politics as war. And so I think his attitude infected a lot of the right. And then there were other figures, Ollie North before him. Remember how much conservatives celebrated Ollie North, even though the fact was that he acted in ways that were deeply irresponsible and deeply unwise. Sarah Palin was an important figure. Mm-hmm. When John McCain chose her, there was so much enthusiasm for her. And you could see the populist impulses showing up. But as time went on and she was interviewed, you could see that there was just no there. This is a person who was not acquainted with ideas in any way, but she became a heroine, on the American right. So I think that happened. I also had the sense, that there was a kind of exhaustion with serious intellectual debate on the right. And more you could see that, serious politics was replaced by the politics of theatrics, and you saw that in all sorts of conservative outlets and certain conservative personalities. And I think that, by the way, is what has why some people on the right are so drawn to Donald Trump. They think it's a great show. They're attracted to this idea of it's a reality show, and I think that they just got flat out tired of arguing the case that, you know, you lower the top corporate tax rate, not to help the rich, but to try and increase economic growth. They'd been making those arguments for 20 or 30 years. And along came Trump, and they thought, you know, this is fun and this is exciting. And the other thing I'd say is this sense of growing grievance and resentment on the American right. And you could detect that if you were listening to some people on talk radio. And even if you listen, say, to Rush Limbaugh, so many years, the way Rush would frame these debates during the 80s when he started nationally, in the 90s and the early 2000s, it was, you know, liberals versus conservatives. But then at the end of the 2000s and in the 2010, 2011, increasingly he and others began to speak in terms of establishment and anti-establishment.
Right.
And you were almost as likely to hear Rush Limbaugh or Mark Levin or others attack John Boehner and Mitch McConnell in 2009, 2010 as Barack Obama. As there was a sense that politics was simple, and why was Obamacare not undone? There was this frustration and impatience with checks and balances. So that went on. And then finally, when Barack Obama won the second term, I think it had a huge psychological impact on the American right.
I think your analysis is exactly right. And of course, you know, I'm cringing as I listen to this because, of course, I was in talk radio for many years and was trying to avoid that. But one of the things that did strike me was, you know, yes, as the talkers became the thought leaders as opposed to people who actually were thinking, you did have this. This perpetual outrage machine, where the audience and the base was fed unrealistic expectations, things that could not possibly happen, and then were told that they had been betrayed and let down when in fact the obvious happened. One of the really striking things about Donald Trump is the way his rhetoric sounds like, and I have a very specific meaning here. His rhetoric is drawn almost directly from really bad talk radio. Mm-hmm. It's like he's listening to the least responsible hosts out there, and he just feeds the narratives and the memes back. And so not a surprise that it resonates. So I want to move on. The heart of your book, and you tell me whether I'm reading this wrong, is basically a plea or a warning for us not to despair, as bad as things are, that there are reasons for hope. And I have to say that this is exactly where I find myself wrestling, thinking, you know what, okay, it is so awful, it is so dumb, it is so mean, it is so dishonest, it is so counterfactual, it is so nakedly the tribal. And yet you're saying, look, let's take a step back. It may feel horrible, but this is not the moment for us to give up on politics.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think you have actually located what the core of my argument is. I mean, there is obviously an alarm bell in the night quality to this, because I think so much of the best of the American tradition is dying before our eyes. And the Trumpification of politics, the cruelty, the crudity, the avalanche of lies, not just the attack, but the assault on truth as a concept, those are very worrisome to me. Now, having said that, I'm not cynical about it, and I'm certainly not hopeless about it for several reasons. One is that if we throw up our hands and give up on the enterprise, there's going to be a huge human cost to that. You can't give up on politics, because when politics goes wrong, disaster follows. So, you know, you can be a theoretical pessimist, but you should be an operational optimist. But I'd say several other things. One is the American capacity for self-renewal is one of the really impressive things about this country. We have to keep context. This nation has faced far worse circumstances than we have now. And politics has been in much worse shape than it has now. I mean, we had the Civil War, the first contested election in American history in 1800 between Adams and Jefferson was a vicious affair. It almost destroyed the early republic. The late 1960s and early 1970s, when you had riots in the streets, the demonstrations, the Vietnam War, Kent State, the riots during the Chicago Convention, There was a period, actually, I talk about this in the book, an 18-month period in 71, 72, there were five domestic bombings a day in America. So we have to remember that this is not the worst period that we've ever had. I also believe that viruses can create their own antibodies. There's often in politics, certain developments create counter-developments. And when things go wrong, that can catalyze efforts to fix them. And I wonder sometimes whether what may have happened is that you know, sometimes in the life of an individual, life of a nation, there are certain qualities, certain virtues that you take for granted, that that you don't realize how important they were until you lose them or you begin to lose them. And then you see why they were significant to begin with. And I think it may be that what Donald Trump is doing is reminding a lot of people why certain virtues, democratic virtues, that maybe we had forgotten were important, why they really are important. And the other thing I would say is that this is a self-governing country. People shouldn't think about our condition like it's a terminal illness. That's not the case. We have the power to write wonderful new chapters in the American story. It doesn't mean that we'll do it. It's not inevitable that we do it, but this is not beyond our capacity or beyond our power. You know, one person acting alone isn't going to do much, but many people acting together can create a culture. And one other thing, just from my own experience, mm-hmm. that may bear on this question. You know, I worked for Bill Bennett in the early 1990s, and we produced a report that you may remember, the Index of Leading Cultural Indicators. And what that was, it took about 18 different cultural indicators, divorce rates, abortion rates, out of wedlock births, teen pregnancy, drug abuse, addiction, suicide, and so forth. And it did an empirical analysis from 1960 to 1990, what had happened. And every one of those indicators got worse. Most of them got significantly worse. By the time we were in the early 1990s, there was a sense that the social fabric was coming apart. And I remember the language that we used at the time, that the forces of decomposition, mm-hmm. social decomposition, were stronger than the forces of composition. And when I was looking at that and looking at the trajectory of the country, I thought things are only going to get worse. And will this republic be able to survive? So take one specific issue.
I remember the same feeling the same way, reading the same document. Yeah.
Because the argument was that culture is upstream of politics, and we had lost the culture, and that relativism and loss of an allegiance to the moral good, all those things had been attenuated, and there really was no break on this slide, on this civic and social slide. And to take one specific issue, which was crime, right? Crime in 1991, 1992 was at record levels. And criminologists, very good criminologists, were saying that the storm had not yet hit, that there was this demographic bulge of young men who were going to come of age in the mid and late 1990s, mm-hmm. and that violent crime in particular was going to skyrocket. What happened? Starting around 1991, 1992, crime began to drop, and it continued to drop, and it just dropped to this day. So New York City, which I think the murder rate in the early 1990s is about 1,900 people a year. I think now it's between 200 and 300 a year in New York City. The murder rate in America is down at the rates of the mid-1960s. The abortion rates today are below a million. They're the lowest level they've been since Roe v. Wade. Teen sexual activity is down. So a lot of progress was made. And some of that progress was through good policy, which underscores why conservatives should care about governing and take it seriously. Some of it was changes in the attitudes of the public, which underscores why it's important to continue to make arguments to the public. And some of it was just that the public began to shift. I think some of the reasons we don't know. The reality is that America in 2019, in a lot of ways, is better and healthier than America in the 1990s. And just to connect it to what we were talking about, that feeling of despair, which was pretty widespread, Bob Bork, mm-hmm. you'll remember, wrote this book, Slouching Toward Gomorrah.
Right.
And there was a feeling that that we just couldn't survive. Or I'll go back even further. You remember when Jean-Francois Revel wrote a book in, I think it was 1981, called Why Democracies Perish?
Yes.
And that was pretty fashionable on the right. And it was an old critique. It said, liberal democracies withstand the iron discipline of the totalitarian regimes? And what happened less than a decade after Revel wrote that book, America prevailed and the Soviet Union had fallen. So I say all of this because history can take funny turns and you can't be fatalistic about these things. None of us knows the outcome of events, but each of us has the capacity to do what we can to try and shape the outcome of events. And that's mm-hmm. one of the things that I argue in my book. It's something I feel deeply about.
None of those changes, those positive changes, were really foreseeable in the 1990s. That's an interesting point. You know, it's interesting because I was making a list the other day because I wanted to ask somebody this question of all of those moments that you had gone through a little while ago, you know, of, you know, terrible crises in American history. I mean, you look at, you know, 1860 through 1880, pretty horrible times for democracy, a civil war, an impeachment, rampant corruption, all the other times, the 1970s, the Great Depression, all of those things. And yet right now, and you've just gone through how things have gotten better on almost all of those indexes, why does it feel so bad? Why do we think that things are falling apart when objectively, historically, okay, it's not good,
right?
But you know, we have gone through much worse, and also this sense of despair and defeatism on the right, when in fact you just went through a litany of cultural indicators where things have gotten so good. So, you know, why is there, is it an illusion that things are so bad, or is it because we've basically been sewn into a bag with one another, and all of our differences, we are just like right up against one another, and we can't get away from the disdain and the contempt and the anger and the threats? Is it real, or is it just perceived, or is the perception reality? I'm sorry if I get incoherent there, but
no, yeah, not incoherent. It's a very deep question, and it's a very good question. And I guess one way to think about it is, you know, why do we feel so bad when in many respects things are so good?
Exactly.
I mean, I have a partial and tentative answers to that. One of the things that I think has happened is within American society today that there is a tremendous amount of alienation and loneliness and disconnectedness. We know that from social science research. We know that from psychology, from self-reporting. There's a large increase in suicides, particularly among young people. A former surgeon general said that there's a loneliness epidemic in America, mm-hmm. which itself is a complicated phenomenon, which I think is driven by a kind of extreme freedom and a sort of licentiousness that took over a move away from order. But I also wonder whether the social media has played a big
role
in this. So I think that is happening, and that's why people themselves seem to be reporting that their lives are unhappy and not fulfilled, because they're not connected in the way that human beings really need to be connected. So I think
I do think that that's right, and I think that I think Ben Sasse wrote about that as well. The loneliness where your family and your bowling team have been replaced by your Twitter feed, and you know, what a surprise, bad things happen as a consequence of that.
Yeah. And the other thing I'll say is back to what I was addressed in the book. I mean, I think our politics now is so acrimonious, so polarized, so contentious, that has an effect as well. In my lifetime, at least, I haven't experienced anything quite like this. And you know, politics ain't beanbag. It's always been a contentious profession. But the antipathy that people have, the sense of real animosity and even hatred for the other side, and the tribalism of politics is beyond anything I've seen. My sense, and I'd be curious whether this is your mm-hmm. sense as well. I think that when it comes to tribalistic politics, it is less affection and loyalties for your side than it is hatred for the other side. I think that is the main thing that's yeah. driving this. And I keep waiting for this bonfire of anger and rage and grievance to settle down, and so far it hasn't. Now, part of that is because we've got a president in Donald Trump who thrives on this kind of thing, who seems to draw emotional energy and purpose out of intentionally dividing people. We've had divisive presidents in our history for sure, but I don't know that we've ever had anybody who is so intentionally divisive and who seems to relish creating acrimony.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, the term is negative partisanship, and you know, I'm fascinated by all the public opinion polls that show how, you know, people do not mind if their children will date or marry someone of a different religion or a different race, but the huge percent of them who would be really unhappy if they dated somebody of a different political party. And that's an indication we're in a strange position. But I think you're exactly right, which is, again, what makes Trumpism so toxic, is that it feeds into that negativism, that we don't know what we are for, but we are damn sure who we hate.
Yeah, no, that's right. I will tell you, I think one of the things that has to happen, a lot of things have to happen to help our politics recover, but one of the things that we have to learn to do is to begin to listen well to one another, to listen to people who have views that are different than ours. That's not easy for anybody. It's not easy for me. But we've got to begin to understand what the purpose of debate and dialogue is. I'll just tell you, I use the story in the book, and it's one that that I love, and it's C.S. Lewis in Surprised by Joy writes about it. It's about halfway through his spiritual autobiography, Surprised by Joy, and Lewis talks about what he refers to as first friends and second friends, and his first friend was a guy named Arthur Greaves, somebody that he knew throughout his life. And Lewis describes first friends as your alter ego. The person who sees the world the same way that that you do, that you start the sentence, they complete it. And we all need that. We all need people that's part of in a community that gives us support and encouragement and helps us see the world the same way. But Lewis also talked about what he referred to as a second friend. And for him, that was Owen Barfield, who was part of the Inklings group that Lewis hosted. And he described the second friend as the anti-self, the person who reads all the same books that you do and draws all the same, all the wrong conclusions from those books. And he talked about how he, Lewis, and Owen Barfield would debate. He talked about going hammer and tong late into the night, leaning into each other's punches. But what was so interesting and what I think is so important for us to learn is that both Lewis and Barfield treasured their friendship precisely because they saw things somewhat different, because they felt like they were better together than they were apart, and that they had something to teach each other. And Barfield said about Lewis, he said, when we debated, we weren't interested in victory. We were interested in truth. And I think that goes to another conservative characteristic, which I would term epistemological modesty, a sense that the world is deeply complicated. And none of us has the capacity, even the best and the wisest among us has the capacity to see the full nature of truth. And that's why we need other people in our lives who see things different than we do, who can refine our views, who can widen our apertures. These days, American politics is now so much, you know, is it my team, you know, trolling the left, trolling the right? And this is one of the things that I think is the corrupting effects of Donald Trump, which is there is, in the view of his supporters, there's no room for dissent or accountability. No. I would not have a problem if Trump supporters would say the fact that people voted for Trump over Hillary Clinton. I understood that. I didn't do it. I didn't vote for either of them, but I understood that argument. What I think is such an indictment of the American right, particularly, frankly, American evangelicals, is that what they will not do is to stand up and hold him accountable, to say, look, we think your court appointments were good, that your deregulation policies were good, we liked your tax cuts, But when it comes to the avalanche of lies, when it comes to the cruelty, when it comes to the mocking of people, when it comes to the efforts to undermine institutions, or when in the Mueller report, the acts of obstruction of justice, those things really bother us. They just won't do that, and the base won't allow them to do it. It's like he is the captain of our team, and we have to protect him no matter what he does. And I think that that is such a terrible thing to have befallen conservatives.
I agree. I mean, and that's the difference between being on a team and being in a cult, where right. I do understand the transactional nature of some of the political decisions that are made, but there is this kind of just intolerance of any sort of criticism that, frankly, is unique, because I remember conservatives criticizing Reagan, Bush 1, Bush 2. That was not a cause for excommunication right. in the way that it is right now. But apparently in the era of Trump, when you're in, you are all in. I mean, when you are in, that's right. it.
I wonder if you share this view. My sense, something has changed in terms of the base and its attitudes toward Donald Trump. You know, early on, I think if he had made a bad Supreme Court appointment, that really would have created problems yeah. for him. I'm not so sure that that would happen anymore. I think that this bond with him now is so deep that he could basically do anything at all, and they would stick with him. We've seen it actually with North Korean Kim Jong-un, right? When he was saying, you know, my button is bigger than yours, and he was saber-rattling, and there was worries that his rhetoric might get us into a war. Trump supporters were saying, it's great, the guy's tough, he's got a backbone, he's not weak like Obama was. And then Trump, you know, turns on a dime, and he talks about these love letters with Kim Jong-un, and he's obsequious in his treatment of him. And those same supporters then champion Trump, say, you know, he's a man of peace, he'll get the Nobel Peace Prize. I think one of the insights that Donald Trump had, one of the real deep insights during the campaign, was when he said that he could go down Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and he wouldn't lose a lot of his supporters. And I detect that going on. And in some ways, I would say that Trump's hold on the base is at least as deep, and maybe in some respects deeper, than Ronald Reagan had. It's an amazing thing to witness.
I think there's
is that your sense?
Yes, and there's a lot of data points that would suggest that that's the case, especially as they play this card of victimization. We're in the foxhole. We're under attack. We can't, we can't worry about any of these small details, and you see that. I mean, any time that there is any sort of criticism, there are people who will rush out immediately, and make the rationalization. But yes, of North Korea, the tariffs, the lying, all of that, again, and once you've gone that far down that path, there is no turning back. So I think that's where we're at. Peter Wehner, thank you so much for the time today. The book is The Death of Politics. It could not be more timely right now. And again, it's been great talking with you.
Thanks a lot, Charlie. Enjoyed it.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.